Thank you all so much for joining us today for CCL's Big Tent Climate Talks. This conversation is a relatively new and engaging monthly series that we're hosting that spotlights diverse leaders in the climate community. At CCL, we know that solving climate change requires a big variety of policies and perspectives, and this is why we do our work under a big tent. And that includes folks from the right, the left, and every spot in between. In our Big Tent Climate Talks episodes, we'll talk to a variety of climate leaders outside of CCL to learn more about how we can all work better together. For starters, I'm Sarah Wanis, and I'm a research coordinator here out of the DC office. I'm stepping in today for Kyle Kameen, whose work focuses on building a coalition of businesses and industry partners in our Big Tent. Overall, our DC team keeps a pulse on what other organizations are doing and finds ways that CCL can collaborate or work with them. And it's my hope that in our session today, we'll give you a little bit of a taste about how our team's conversations with other organizations go. For this episode, CCL is pleased to be hosting a conversation with Gil Jenkins, who's the Vice President of Communications and Public Affairs for Hannon Armstrong. And before we get started, because today's program is a bit more of a back and forth conversation than a one-way conversation, it will feel a little bit different than the typical talks that we host. In that vein, building support for the policy that we support, the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act, we know that that's going to require the biggest and broadest coalition possible. And that's the reason that we want to host conversations like this one. So learning from each other and working together is how we will all get the job done. So without further ado, I'll go ahead and introduce today's guest, a little bit more about Mr. Jenkins. Gil Jenkins is the Vice President of Communications and Public Affairs at Hannon Armstrong, a leading investor in climate change solutions. In this position, he's responsible for guiding the company's communication strategy, including media relations, brand marketing, social media, and external partnerships. He also supports the firm's government affairs, community relations, and philanthropic foundation efforts. Before joining Hannon Armstrong in 2019, he served as Vice President of Communications for the American Council on Renewable Energy, or ACOR. Prior to that, he represented a number of sustainability-focused clients at Ogilvy, a global marketing and public relations agency. He also has held public relations agency roles at Weber Shandwick, Ketchum, and Shift Communications. Gil is a member of the board of directors at the Land Trust Alliance and serves on the advisory boards of Business Climate Leaders, a group that you all might be familiar with here at CCL, the Cleanie Awards, the Clean Project, and a native of Oregon, he holds a bachelor's degree in communication from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. So it's really great to hear about all that background. And those are all places that CCL is going to need to have these relationships and connections. So I'm really glad that we're getting to talk to you today, Gil. Gil, is there anything else that I missed that you'd like folks on this call to know about you?
No, not at all. Thanks, Sarah, and excited to get into this. Thanks for the opportunity.
Great, thanks. And that's great. So we're so fortunate to have you on as our guest on this month's Big Tent Climate Talks. We really appreciate having someone from Hannon Armstrong, since both of our organizations recognize the power of a well-designed carbon price to reduce carbon emissions. And we're working on getting that policy implemented. So all that being said, let's transition to our conversation so I can stop doing all of the talking. So also for the audience, don't worry, we've saved some time at the bottom of the hour for questions for audience Q&A. So go ahead and fill those out in the Q&A part of Q&A feature on Zoom, and we'll get to as many of those as we can. But for the first part, I'll be asking Gil for his perspectives and experiences on some questions I've already queued up for our conversation. So first of all, Gil, how'd you get into the climate movement?
Well, I think there's a few different ways I could answer that. I'll start with the personal, good place to start. I think it's sort of at my core. I've always been attracted to environmental stewardship. Perhaps it was growing up in Oregon. But I have to credit my parents. I'm a double preacher's kid, and my grandfather, who was a theologian, and I come from Congregationalists. So I like people, community, and my faith on some deep level, I'm sure, informs my notion of stewardship for the planet. I think having a being a young father, I'm thinking a lot about what kind of world we're going to leave for his generation. And so that grounds me in a professional sense. Thinking about the climate movement, it really started in most in depth for me when I was at Ogilvy and Mather, which is a big advertising and public relations agency out in San Francisco. And we were starting to see a lot of interest from what we call legacy industry brands that were embracing sustainability for one reason or another. I think it was, you know, some of it bordering greenwash as I reflect on it, but a lot of, you know, sincere attempts to reimagine their business, attract different customers, younger folks. And when you're in San Francisco, you're sort of on the leading edge of this conversation in some respects. And at the time, there was also a lot of interest from the venture capitalist community in clean tech. And I was still relatively one of the young people there. And I thought, oh, this, I've been doing work for all sorts of industries. And I thought this would be a good opportunity to get these kinds of clients that are very much mission driven that resonated with me. And I leapt at it and we sort of created a clean tech communications practice at Ogilvy and worked on all sorts of interesting clean energy technologies and startups at various stages of success and failure. That led to some work for big brands, and I worked on some of the earlier electric vehicles for Ford and for GM. And so it's been fun to see, you know, 10 or so years later, how much that's changed. These are sort of the mainstreaming of that. Culminated for me when I came out again, more towards the climate policy, coming out to DC. And I had the opportunity to work for the governor of Peru at the COP right before Paris. So, you know, that was a 2-week incredible transformational experience working on international climate policy for a host country. So I got a lot of depth on the policy side, and being in DC, of course, leads to that. Was at Acor, fighting the good fight for renewable energy business at a time of great hostility towards that industry. And I got a lot of meaning out of that and eventually got to Hannon about 2 years ago, which is really, you know, resonates with me on so many levels in my calling and sense of intersection of business and climate and investing. And, you know, I'm in a privileged position that I don't think, you know, this company's been around a long time, but positions and the need for communications related to climate related businesses. When I started my career, you know, there weren't as many opportunities, and it's been incredible to see how much it's grown. And certainly we need to do more. One thing I would just say is I like quotes. And when I think about climate and the climate movement, for me, there's a quote by JFK that, he wasn't talking about climate, but I think if he were today, it would reference that. He was talking about, this is an American University speech. And he said that our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's future, and we are all mortal. So for me, that really sums up my views on climate and humanity and nature. And it's been a driving force that I try to think about in my day-to-day.
Wow, that really is the perfect quote. And it's so cool to hear about all of your professional background. It really reflects how there isn't a silver bullet solution to climate change. There are so many different facets of this issue that are all going to need attention. You covered things from EVs to international negotiations at COP to renewables, and like now the investments in all of those kinds of technologies. So that's really awesome to hear. I'm glad that we have someone with your depth of experience working with us here at CCL. But that kind of leads me into, what projects and areas of focus does your organization work on now, Hannon Armstrong?
Well, you know, as I mentioned, the company's actually been around 40 years. This year is our 40th year. When I say Hannon Armstrong, you know, who knows what we could be selling insurance. So it's my job to sort of change the notion of what we do. But we went public as a company in 2013 with an investment thesis that I think was very pioneering and still on some level, sadly, this notion that in a world increasingly defined by climate change, we believe we'll make better risk-adjusted returns by investing on the right side of climate. And what do I mean by the right side of climate? It really goes back to our investment screen and our thesis, which is that everything we invest in should improve our climate future, which is why all prospective investments either need to be neutral to negative on carbon emissions or have another tangible environmental benefit, such as reducing water consumption, or we're not going to invest in it. But importantly, this, you know, there's a lot of buzzwords in sustainable finance and investing and impact investing. This is an investable opportunity, and you can't make a difference if you're not in business. So we think the returns are great here. And I think there's a lot of misperceptions about the subsidies required. We're not interested in, we're in here for the long term. We're investing in 20, 30, 40 year assets. I'll just say that's, you know, solar in all its forms, residential, commercial and industrial, community, utility scale solar, solar under land, wind. We do a lot of energy efficiency projects for the federal government in terms of providing the upfront capital. And another part of our business is investing in ecological restorations and natural climate solutions. So that's how we can truly say that, you know, as our tagline emphasizes as well, you know, we're investing in climate solutions. So we'll go after the carbon. We're saving customers money and helping our clients grow, who are really doing the hard work and the engineering and the project development. And, you know, it's just incredible how much momentum there is in the clean and green space. So I hope I answered your question. We focus on a lot, but also quite precise in our niches. It's just, again, to provide capital to the companies by investing in their projects who are making a difference in the climate fight.
Totally. And I love a piece of what you said there, which I feel like really resonates with what we're doing here at CCL, which you said, you can't make a difference if you're not in business, which isn't, right. Business isn't the only thing that we focus, business isn't the main thing that we focus on here at CCL, it's Congress. But in the solution that we focus on, carbon pricing, a big part of that is that we need a way to orient businesses all in the right direction and to incentivize investments like the ones that you all are already seeing a case for and maybe accelerate that kind of incentive. So it's awesome to hear about that. The next question I had is, I feel like this is a very common thing, especially in the environmental space. Like you were talking about, there's so many buzzwords out there. What's maybe something that people assume about Hand and Armstrong that isn't true?
Well, I get these a lot as the communications guy. It really depends on the audience that I'm talking to. So I'll take a wild guess that most of you weren't familiar with Hand and Armstrong before on this call. So I don't know. I think on some level, there's a misconception that, are you just like a bank? Well, sort of not technically. Are you a private equity investor? Are you investing in the companies? No, we're investing in the assets. And while I don't think it's true for this audience, I think a common misconception still, although it's changing, is the notion that, you know, clean energy business is like speculative and is a lot of risk. And I don't think that's really true. It hasn't been true for a while, but with the costs falling dramatically on wind and solar and energy efficiency, again, is something we've invested in for 30, 40 years now. Yes, the technologies are improving, but it's not dependent on subsidies in some of the cases. We're investing in commercially ready big projects, small projects, repeatable projects. And so unfortunately there's, you know, sometimes I don't think with this audience still a taint that, you know, this is a niche or a risky play. And we have some really serious experienced people at the firm. One of the reasons I came, people that actually were investing in solar in the 80s, which I find fascinating, you know, before it was cool. So we're not taking crazy wild bets. You know, we're looking at the economics and the long-term value, and it's absolutely there. And there's so much we have to do. And I think when you talk about bringing finance and capital to the problem, we sort of think of ourselves as a challenger brand. You know, again, if a vision is that every investment should improve our future and we think you can make money on these investments, we want to see the other major capital providers really commit more earnestly to financing this accelerated transition. There's a lot of talk about big sustainable finance commitments, and those sound good. But if you're still financing coal, those are financed emissions that we're going to pay for later. So you got to report that is sort of step one, so everyone can know that. But you need to talk about all your investments, not just the ones you want to talk about.
Awesome. Thanks for that. I was also wondering, what are some of your thoughts on how we can best be in the climate movement together? For example, what are some ways that CCL could be the most helpful?
Well, look, I think what's unique about CCL is the largely singular issue focus on why this organization was created and why it's sustained. And that is really rare and really essential in the echo chamber of climate policy and NGOs. So your focus on a carbon fee and dividend and continuing to be the absolute subject matter experts and the strongest advocates for that is so critical, particularly when perhaps larger or more established in some respects, more financed big NGOs have, gotten the alphabet soup of all the other climate things that, yes, we need to do those too, but maybe have soured on the politics or the aspects of carbon fee and dividend. And it's been very frustrating on some level, but I really appreciate CCL's focus on that. The other thing I would say is, and you've probably heard this, is particularly with the progressive community, and we need to keep that bipartisan focus, but if there's an opportunity for this in a budget reconciliation and continuing to educate folks and combat misperceptions about, I think, what is really a good story in terms of equity with respect to this policy and environmental justice. It's I think there's a lot of myth busting we have to do there, or even just continue to educate folks on forgetting the dividend part. So all the work that I see CCL doing, from letters to the editor, op-eds, like, keep it up. I know that's tough, but it matters. And a few other things I would say is, I guess what I've been a fan of CCL for a while before this role. And I think, I was thinking a lot about, every Earth Day, there's articles go around about, hey, how can you make a difference on climate in your everyday life? And it's always the same five things. And those are good things, individual choices, right? Like, buy an EV. Sure, if do that, you can. Eat less red meat, put LEDs in, go solar. I think the most powerful thing we as individuals and collectively can do is to get engaged on policy advocacy. So that needs to be in the top five when these lists that keeps coming around. So get others involved, tell your friends. And then the last thing I would say is, I think there's an opportunity with you all. Many of you work at businesses yourself or other organizations. Get them to be involved, as my firm is. And it's almost better if they're not big companies, because we need to show the depth of support across small and medium-sized businesses as well, which is, there's a lot of other business groups that are, we're involved in as well, that are, understand carbon pricing is the way to go. But you guys have the ability to build a coalition of really compelling, diverse, small and medium-sized businesses. So that's what comes to mind. I think you all are wonderful, and it's been nice to be on the front lines with you all.
Thanks. Yeah, there are so many good focal points there, especially, I mean, we can't agree more with how important it is to bring people into the policy advocacy of this all. And I can speak for myself that I truly didn't understand how much of a difference my voice could make until getting involved with CCL as a volunteer 5 years ago. So thanks for that reminder for everyone to keep inviting people into this kind of work too, because it matters. And now the money question that I know that all of the volunteers on the line have been waiting for me to ask. What are your organization's thoughts on putting a rising price on carbon emissions and returning the revenue to households? And what's your ideal or preferred way of designing ambitious climate policy?
Well, I think, you know, I'm speaking to the choir here too, because you know, we've endorsed the EICDA. And
thank you for that.
But what I would say, it boils down to a few things. So it's at a high level when I think about this. Number one, if the goal is deep decarbonization and a strong economy, a carbon fee and dividend has to be the cornerstone policy. Other policies we advocate for and think are important, yes, energy efficiency standards are important, direct investments to disadvantaged communities. You know, I would, there's some other things that are they're important, but I just don't, the sectoral approach or regs only, you know, we still need regs. So I was pleased to see that update, and it's important to have those there for the politics. But that's number one. Number two, we think about it through the lens of the equity lens in terms of, you know, designing it in a way we're fine with the equal lump sum payments, but would be open to, you know, maybe putting 75% of the revenues and maybe just directing those to people who make less than $400,000 a year, for example, or less. Maybe using 25% of the revenue for just transition or other things. We think that the direct tax when the carbon enters the economy on companies, mind you, it's really a corporate carbon fee, which people also forget. It's just so much more efficient than other forms of carbon pricing, like cap and trade, for example. And that's going to stimulate the most investment. And frankly, that's the investment in the economic growth we need to get to the net zero future. Again, I'm not an economist or a scientist, but I've seen enough to know that I just don't see how we drive the level of investment just from government spending without bringing the private sector in to get to net zero without a price on carbon. So, and last, look, if science, you have the IPCC, you know, what, the 4,000 economists, health leaders, business leaders like us, business groups, all think that this is one of the most impactful things we could do. You know, that's sort of good enough for me. And I think a lot about, we make out the argument through the lens of economists say, right? And economists aren't always the best communicators, much like scientists, right? Or the most convincing to joke you public. But, and I may run this by you all, this notion, when I think a lot about how 97% of climate scientists agree the global warming is man-made, I don't know if it's quite that amongst all the leading economists in the world also agreeing the parallel, which is a price on carbon is the most impactful thing we could do to address carbon. But again, maybe wrong messenger, but still some truth there. So that's how we think about it. And, you know, we need to change the politics. We need to sell the benefits, and the benefits are different depending on who you're talking to. But I think we all can agree that this is something that's going to generate potentially trillions of dollars of investment in decarbonization across the economy. Because American businesses are more efficient, you know, with the border adjustment tax, that's actually going to create a competitive advantage to win the jobs of the future that we talk about. And we do need other policies, but we're not going to be able to sort of patchwork subsidize our way out of it. And God help us if we don't use this opportunity really in the next 6 months, but certainly this decade, to do something big on federal policy and carbon pricing, should be a part of that. So many of the other policies, while well-intentioned and meaningful, just aren't focused enough on creating the demand that's going to drive the accelerated. It's too much about the supply. And if it's just supply, that means projects are getting built where they're easiest. That's not efficient, and we're not getting at the harder to abate sector. So you've got me. I'm read all the literature. I'm a consumer of all this stuff too. I appreciate all that you're doing. And, we've tried everything else. So it's just funny. Sometimes when you get in these debates, people sort of admit, we know it's the right answer, but it's like, well, yeah, it is the right answer.
So, I find myself doing that too. Just the more I read, the more I'm like, if all signs are pointing this way, seems like that's where we should be heading. Speaking of reading, one last question from me before I start taking our volunteers' questions. So just a reminder, everyone, to throw those in the Q&A if you have any for Gil. What's at the top of your reading stack right now? I see you have a big bookshelf behind you. What can you recommend?
Well, I assure you I've read at least 75% of the books behind me. I won't lie and say I've read all of them. So I'm not one of those pretentious people that people are like ordering stacks of books in the Zoom world that they haven't read just for the aesthetic. So I do like books. I would say that with a three-year-old, I don't get to read as much as I like. And I like podcasts and I read a lot of news. So why don't I tell you, cause I've got a stack here, that here's what I'm planning to read. And hopefully that's enough of a recommendation, and I'm going to go a little all over the place. So one, I did pick up A Sand County Almanac by Aldo Leopold, which is really, a series of essays on the natural world and a kind of a foundational text for the conservation community. This is going to be a little random. I could tell you all climate books, but I'm a huge San Francisco 49ers fan, and we had a coach in the 80s named Bill Walsh, who was a transformational leader, innovator in the West Coast offense. And so I picked up his book about leadership called The Score Takes Care of Itself. Business books can be a little corny, but I get to read about sports too. And I do think he was a great leader of people and an innovator. So, and then, another classic that I can't believe I hadn't read. I'm finally picking up The Omnivore's Dilemma, because we have a book club at Hannon Armstrong and we pick texts every month. So that's just one that's been on my shelf for a while that I actually hadn't read. So that's top of mind in terms of, I would encourage you all to check out Canary Media, which is something we were proud to support their launch. They're the new, the folks who were at Green Tech Media went over and partnered with RMI to start Canary Media. So it's a really good climate tech journalism, and that's plenty.
Good to know. Yeah. I was just about to say, you have a podcast, right? Do you want to tell us about that?
Well, as I mentioned, the podcast. So our pandemic hobby, a few colleagues and I, wanted a creative outlet and expression and a way to connect. We started a podcast, which isn't wholly original for a company or an enterprise to do, but it's called Climate Positive, and please check it out. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And it's an interview series that we just started. And, we're trying to talk to other business leaders and scientists and policymakers others who inspire us and who have a great story to tell and have, made it their life's mission to tackle this monster. I think when you think of climate podcasts or climate media, broadly speaking, there's a lot of, it's tough, right? There's a lot of climate doomism, and I read that stuff too. And I don't want to sound Pollyannish by saying we have a podcast called Climate Positive. That means a lot of different things, but I want to focus on the solutions and the people and build around that, in part because, you know, slipping too far into the doomism, we're not gonna have the energy and the fortitude to make every bit of incremental difference, which matters. I think there's some science that supports that too, that see, everyone watch out for that. It's tough once you get into the literature not to be depressed, but balance your climate diet with stories and people that inspire you as well.
Thanks for that reminder. It's a good one. So now jumping into some of the questions that our volunteers on the call have. This one says, how much money does an individual investor need to put down to be a part of Hannon Armstrong's products?
Wow. Well, I mean, I have to be careful here. I can't. So we are publicly traded, HASI. The shares have been up, so you can look at us as an investment, or look at some of the clients we support, and you know, varying degrees of share price. I'd say we're on discount right now. We've had a very successful run, but most of our investors are institutions. But I do think I would encourage you to look at. There are a lot of like sort of blended options, ETFs that are sort of focused on ESG or have carbon commitments, and our stock ends up being in those funds as well. And those are doing well, and they're good long-term investments. So I wish I could tell you there's no one share, 10 shares. Sort of do the research on the right funds and blends, and pick companies that you think are solidly managed and are making a good return, and I hope you'll consider Hannon Armstrong among those. But
awesome. And on a totally different thread, this volunteer asked, there's an increasing interest in hydrogen technology products and infrastructure worldwide as being transportation and a hard to decarbonize sector fuel. In Alaska, sure, we have lots of stranded wind resources that could be used to generate green hydrogen. What trends do you see as far as movement towards hydrogen investments in the U.S.?
Well, I think it's early days on green hydrogen. There's also, you know, most of the hydrogen produced today in the U.S. around the world is not produced through renewable energy, through electrolysis to create the clean fuel. I think, you know, for us, it's a little early for us as an investment class. I'm certainly having a price on carbon would spur that demand. There's also some talk of some specific tax credits. I think it's got a role certainly in maybe heavy transport and industrial. You can reuse some of the same infrastructure for pipelines, but you know, with anything with these technologies, like there's so much we have to do and can do from things like energy efficiency and behind the meter solar plus storage, electric vehicles, like, and for transportation. I'm not saying we shouldn't be focusing on the harder to abate sectors right now, but I'm not sure the economics are totally there. There's a shortage on parts for electrolysis, you know, electrolyzers as well, but it's definitely coming faster than I thought. So, you know, ask me again in 2 years. You do see major oil companies seeing this finally as a way for them to make the transition and grow their business because they were a little late on renewables. So green hydrogen, very, very exciting, makes sense certainly in Alaska and in lots of different applications, but it's, we need more projects out there.
Thanks for your perspective on that. And also, I think that someone picked up on your experience with electric cars. So someone asked, California is committing to the scale of to the sale of only electric cars in the near future, but people are still going to want to drive long distances without stopping to charge for long periods of time. What do you see as the future of electric cars?
Well, I don't know. You know, I don't know exactly what the market penetration for renewables is now. It's maybe 2% of all cars sold. So it is a big deal that all new cars sold by, I think, 2030 or 2035 in California, which is, the sixth largest economy in the world, the number one car market for sure. I think there's 30 plus new EVs coming out from automakers this year. I get the range argument. My electric has only 150 miles range, but it's fine because I'm just commuting 50 miles each way and I charge in the place. But I'm recalling some of the research back on the Volt and some of the Ford EV projects. It's like, I think we as Americans like to think we take all these really long trips in our cars, but in actuality, I don't know. It strikes me that it's a couple times a year. And when you're talking 300-400 miles of range, I like to stop on the trip up north a few times just for refreshments. I don't want to diminish the concerns about range anxiety, but I think they're largely being addressed with the falling prices of batteries and the increased battery size and efficiency. And that also, the cars are not, they're just getting to the point, I think, of comparison with internal combustion engine cars. So, with the future, I think with major automakers doubling down, seeing what Tesla has done and their success, it's coming and it's perhaps not coming fast enough, and it's going to require some additional policy support and incentives. But the choices are plentiful now, and increasingly, I think the perceived sacrifices are less and less. And I do think once most people experience an electric vehicle, it's hard to consider going back because they're fun to drive. And it's also fun not getting your oil changed or stopping at a gas station either. And maybe 15 minutes on a fast charge to top off on a long trip. That's not that much worse than 5 minutes to fill her up. So I don't know. I don't want to diminish the concerns. They're real, but I think it's changing fast with some of the advancements we've seen.
Totally. And if I could chime in here a little bit too, I'm really encouraged about the idea of seeing the electric Ford F-150 coming out, being the most purchased car on the market. Just having more kinds of options like that available to people is going to be a really great option.
Yeah, quick story on that. So I worked on the Ford Focus Electric and the Focus Energy plugins. And I remember this is 10 or 12 years ago now. And I always was like, you know what, Ford, why really be cool if you put it on the vehicles that matter, like the F-150 that they sell the most of and the Mustang. So those decisions for these companies to put that on their kind of hero whole business type of product is a big deal. So I do think that was a tipping point. I hope it's successful, that it's not going to be for every person that needs a truck for certain utility, but I think a lot of people have trucks too. And just cause they like riding in trucks, not cause they need some crazy towing capacity. And, the electrician who's driving out is he's just driving the F-150 with a few things in the back and goes back to the shop and can plug it right in. So I'd love to see that do well. And it was exciting, the launch a few weeks ago.
Very cool. Another question here. It says, what do you think about recent shareholder activism forcing fossil fuel companies to affect business change that are climate positive?
I think it's terrific. So you're referring to the, in particular, the big news yesterday, I think, with the activist investors and ExxonMobil.
Yeah, I must have missed this myself.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, this sort of thing has been around for a while. We're a part of a group called Ceres, which I think was involved with that campaign. I will say, though, that this was the first one that it wasn't just getting like one climate activist on the board. I mean, they're potentially having four. And that's, you know, that's going to fundamentally change a laggard and Exxon in terms of, you know, maybe acting more like some of the European oil majors that have finally came. So I think it's a big deal. I think it's a validation of the tactic that, you know, probably started with the 350s of the world and others, and has become more and more mainstream. So that, and then the lawsuit and the successful lawsuit in the Dutch court. I mean, this is accelerating, and we should take a moment. And if you're involved with that, I applaud you, and certainly need more of it. So.
Wonderful. And we are coming to the end of our time here. So I wanted to ask, do you have any closing words of wisdom or any reflections today that you'd like to share before we wrap up?
Well, I already shared my favorite JFK quote. So,
it's a good one.
I would just say, you know, keep the faith, keep the vigor. You all inspire me. And I mean that. You know, wear a hat as a professional business lobbyist, have lots of different meetings, but I really relish the chances I've had to join my fellow citizens in my local chapter and talk to my local stakeholders. And it's been fun having a different conversation in that way and a different reaction. And so it's been a crazy year and a half. It seems like things are getting better and as we come together, and I would just encourage you all to find that extra gear and recognize you're part of a really special community and a really powerful and influential community, and help grow it and help make it better. And thanks for listening to me blather on for a few minutes, and go forth.
Yes. Thank you so much for everything today. This has been a really great conversation. It's always hard to wrap these up because I just want to keep talking forever with you all. But thank you so much for your time today. Just a brief reminder for everyone of where you can find today's recording and share it with those who couldn't join us live, as well as our education director, Brett Cease's email. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, they're all up here on the screen now. And lastly, here's also the websites for both Citizens Climate Lobby and Hannon Armstrong. If you'd like to get more involved and active as well, the registration link to sign up for the future months of Big Ten Climate Talks is up there as well. We will be back next month at the same time in the same place every month on the fourth Thursday of the month at 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 p.m. Pacific, and stay tuned for who we'll have joining us next. We'll announce that on Citizens Climate Lobby Community soon. Thank you again to Gil and to all of the important work that Hannon Armstrong is doing. Stay safe and be well, everyone. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.